This week, it's the season finale of Meat and Three. We're following up our episode about youth with a look at age and how aging affects life on farms and in kitchens.
At the most basic level, we need people to grow food for a growing global population.
The question of planning for retirement or old age as a cook, it's almost one that doesn't exist bizarrely until it's too late.
We also have a story about a food that might be older than you think.
A recent archaeological finding might have CrossFitters everywhere reevaluating their diets.
Plus, a story about one of Atlanta's most historic and risque landmarks.
There are dancers that have been there 20 and 30 years.
Don't miss our season finale of Meat and Three, available wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, everybody. I'm your host, Carrie Diamond, and you're listening to Radio Cherry Bomb. Each week, we talk to the most interesting women in the world of food and bring the pages of Cherry Bomb magazine to life. First, thank you to today's sponsor, Le Cordon Bleu, for supporting Radio Cherry Bomb. If you are daydreaming about culinary school, maybe it's time to say bonjour to Le Cordon Bleu. Learn more about the legendary culinary school's most prestigious professional qualification, Le Grand Diplôme, by visiting cordonbleu.edu. Several of you have DM'd me over the past few months to tell me that you've signed up for classes at Le Cordon Bleu, and one of our favorites, Wandering Whisk, on Instagram, told me she's taking some macaroon classes right now, and I'm very jealous. I think she's over there real time, and hopefully you checked out her Instagram story on our Instagram account yesterday. And Bob's Red Mill. Bob's Red Mill is an employee-owned company that has been offering organic, gluten-free, and stone-ground products for decades. With Bob's Red Mill, you're not just getting quality, you're getting flavor-packed food that tastes amazing. Visit bobsredmill.com today. I'm always super curious about Bob, and someone recommended that I listen to How I Made This. I think that's the name of the podcast. And there was one with Bob, and he is as quirky as you would expect. So if you're looking for other podcasts, definitely check that one out. And he's a late bloomer. It's always interesting to hear about late bloomers who figure out their thing. I think he was maybe 50 before he even figured out the whole Bob's Red Mill thing, which is just fascinating. I hope you're all having a great summer. If you love ice cream as much as we do here at Cherry Bomb, you need to check out CB Scoop, our first digital issue dedicated to all things ice cream. You can find it at cherrybomb.com. We've got fun Q&As with some of the coolest makers out there, including Fanny Gerson of La New Yorkina, right here in New York City. She is an expert on Mexican ice cream and has some fabulous cookbooks on the subject. Then there's our friend Hannah Spiegelman of A Sweet History in Baltimore, and so many others. It's incredible to see how many women have gotten into the craft ice cream scene and how many of them were kind of spurred into this or onto this, inspired by Jenny, Britton Bauer of Jenny's Ice Creams. They all mentioned her as someone who has inspired them and the reason they got into this business. We will be adding more content over the next few days on our site and on Instagram, so check it out. We will also talk to our guest about ice cream because she did a special ice cream collab that I happened to try when I was in Portland. I was very excited about that. I was in Portland for the Future of Food tour that we've been on, and we were just in Austin this past weekend and met so many incredible women. There are just incredible people in the Austin scene doing very cool things. The event was held at the Line Hotel, where Chef Kristen Kish just opened her first restaurant called Arlo Gray. We ate there on Sunday night. Kristen spoiled us rotten, and we had a lot of incredible food. So thank you, Chef Kristen. What else? I just announced a cool project today for my coffee shop, Smith Canteen, in Brooklyn. We are calling it the Green Canteen Project. Ready? And we are going single-use plastic-free by January 1st, 2019. That means no more single-use plastic cups, lids, utensils, takeout containers. It's kind of crazy. I know it, but I think we can do it, and we're going to learn a lot. And we figured January 1st was a reasonable timeline. You know, we didn't want to come back after Labor Day and say to all our all of our guests. Guess what? No more plastic cups. But we're also going to be doing an audit of all our front and back of house procedures to make sure we're being as green as possible. And I'm working on it with Joey Paleo, our director of operations, and Gabby Vigoro, our culinary director and baker, who you've heard before on Radio Cherry Bomb. I want us to be the greenest coffee shop in America. why not, right? Yeah. In America. Really, Brooklyn. I want us to be the greenest coffee shop in Brooklyn. But America, I'll take that too. You know, one of the real reasons we're doing it is I just couldn't handle the guilt over all the plastic anymore. You know, if you follow me on Instagram, you know I do beach cleanups every now and then, and my brother's a huge environmentalist. But the plastic situation was really just making me super depressed. So I hope we can make some change. If you don't already carry a reusable cup, please consider it. This is not a paid endorsement, but I love my Keep cup. It's glass, but it's very sturdy and practical, and I use it for hot and cold coffee. So BYOC, bring your own cup. And if you know anyone who is an expert in the plastic-free space, or if you want to talk best practices, just DM me. I have a lot to learn about all of this, but I'm committed to making change. We are also looking for some environmentally minded baristas. So if that's you or you know any, get in touch. I would love to talk to you. So speaking about committed to change, today's guest is Chef Tracy Desjardins, and she is a major change agent on the San Francisco scene. Chef Tracy is passionate about women's place in the industry, immigrants' place in the industry, sustainability, the city of San Francisco, and much more. She has 7 restaurants in San Francisco, including her famous flagship, I'm going to get the pronunciation of this correct, Jardiniere. And her latest project is School Night, a collaboration with the Pearl Event Space. She was a longtime board member of La Cocina, a local nonprofit that helps female food entrepreneurs from low-income communities formalize and grow their business. Tracy Desjardins has long been one of the women we look up to here at Cherry Bomb. She is a force and an inspiration. I hope I'm not embarrassing you as you sit there. Chef Tracy, welcome to Radio Cherry Bomb.
Thanks, Carrie.
It is such an honor to finally have you here.
It's awesome to be here.
Oh my God, we really do. We look up to you so much. I remember when I first learned about you before I started going to San Francisco all the time. It was in Charlotte Druckmann's book.
Oh yeah.
Skirt
yeah.
Steak.
Yeah, yeah. It's a great book.
I hope a lot of you have read that book. It's fantastic. And Charlotte really was one of the first to want women in this industry to get more attention and to claim their rightful place.
Yeah, it's a wonderful book. I mean, she spent a lot of time talking to a lot of really interesting people for that piece, and it was, you know, fabulous.
She absolutely did. So I want to jump right into something I read a few weeks ago. Kim Severson, everybody who listens, I'm sure knows Kim. She's the brilliant Pulitzer Prize winning writer of the New York Times. She did a piece about reporting during the Me Too era, and she opened the story with Tracy and a story about how Tracy dealt with some hazing and harassment in the kitchen. But you pointed out that Tracy was 19 and had an apprenticeship in France. So you're from Northern California, right?
Mm-hmm.
I'm wondering, how did this 19-year-old Northern California girl wind up in a kitchen in the middle of France?
I ask myself that all the time. I started cooking when I was 17 in Los Angeles. And, you know, at the time, different era, there weren't restaurants like the French Laundry and you know, 3-star Michelin places here. And so if you really wanted to study French cooking, which is what I wanted to do, it seemed like the only place to go. And so,
but wait, 17, cooking in Los Angeles, that's like high school age.
I know. I graduated from high school a year early and dropped out of college pretty quickly and wanted to cook. And so I found this amazing chef, Joachim Spichel, who had just come over from France and was opening his first restaurant in L.A., and he gave me a crack at getting in the kitchen and seeing what I could do.
So what was 17-year-old Tracy Desjardins like?
Intense. You know, I was super ambitious. I thought that I wanted to be a doctor or a veterinarian, and so I was, you know, on a trajectory that, you know, took a big deviation. And when I dropped out of college, of course, my parents weren't very happy with me. And so, you know, they said, I wanted to be a ski bum, actually. And so I said, okay, I'm just going to become a cook so I can support my skiing. And that was sort of the vision, you know, that I had. It wasn't very, you know, it wasn't a long vision. It was a very short vision. And then I got into cooking, and it just, you know, the first day in the kitchen, it just all, you know, resonated for me. And I was like, this is what I want to be doing. There's no question whatsoever.
What was the kitchen like back then?
Well, I mean, Joachim was a super intense guy. You know, he screamed constantly. He was crazy talented and surrounded by really talented young Americans, mostly. There were a lot of, you know, French guys in the kitchens with him as well. But it was, you know, we were doing, like, multiple tasting menus. You know, the restaurant that I worked in with him had five different tasting menus. There was a vegetarian, a spa menu. You know, it was crazy. When I look back at those menus, I think, God, we were way, way, way ahead of the curve. And, you know, it set my bar really high, and I wanted to go and work with the very best. And to me, at that point in time, it meant working in France. And so I set my sights on that, and off I went. I mean, had I known, you know, what I know now, there's no way I would have done it. But, you know, it was super hard. And
so really, there's no, you wouldn't do it again?
Oh, I would do it again. But if I had known what I know now, I wouldn't have made that choice, because it was, you know, really, really difficult.
And did you speak French?
Nope. No. But, kitchen's kitchen. And, you know, the techniques and the names of things are all the same. And so that part was easy. I went over and took an intensive French course for like 3 months, and then started working. And I think I had a headache for like six months, you know, just concentrating so hard on trying to figure out what was going on, what was being said, and, you know, where I needed to be.
So how welcoming were they to this 19-year-old Northern Californian woman?
Oh, you know, not very. They didn't know what to do with me. I mean, literally, like, you know, the chef was showing me around the first day, and he looked at me as if, like, he hadn't realized that I was female, and said, oh, well, you know, I have to find a place for you to change. Can't you just come in your uniform? So that was, you know, he literally was just caught off guard, just like, I don't know. I mean, it was like he'd never had a female in the kitchen before. And I don't think that Judy Rogers actually worked at Trois Gros, which was the kitchen that I was in France at that time. But she came over as an exchange student living with the family, the Trois Gros family, Jean Trois Gros. And so she had actually worked in that kitchen as well. But I think it was different. She was a high schooler, and so she was there in that environment. But I was, you know, the only female amongst, you know, these young men who were between 18 and 23 years old. And so, you know, I just imagine what that was like.
How did you even talk your way into that job?
You know, it was a family connection. I had an aunt and uncle who were big foodies and would go to France twice a year and eat in all the, you know, 3-star Michelin restaurants. And so they befriended the Trois Gros, and they just made the ask. And so they said, yeah. And I mean, you know, I don't think they knew what they were getting themselves into either. It was just a real oddity. And so the guys were, of course, they wanted to be mean to me, but they were secretly also fascinated. And as soon as I sort of figured that out, you know, I realized I could sort of use it to my advantage. So, you know, I was this California girl, you know, they were just like, what are you? Like, you know, so there was a lot of curiosity.
And you were the only woman in the kitchen?
I was the only woman in the kitchen, yeah. Wow. And I mean, I went on to live and work in France for a year and a half. And so I worked in 3 other kitchens, and I was always the only woman.
Wow. What? So back to that first job, what were some of the tasks that they gave you?
So they put me on the amuse-gaule station. So that was, you know, sort of low rung in the kitchen. And I was responsible for producing, you know, 3 amuse-gaule that went on a plate that went out to everybody every day, twice a day. So it was, that was my station. And then, you know, I kind of did pick up and helped with any other projects that were coming. But, you know, definitely low man on the totem pole, low woman on the totem pole.
Are those days of apprenticeship dead?
You know, I don't know. I mean, I think, you know, people are still really interested in doing it, but I think that, you know, there's so many different places that you can go now. You know, the world of food has changed so much. There are so many opportunities here in this country. You know, obviously everything's going on in the Nordic countries and in Spain, you know, South America, Mexico, you know, I mean, it's amazing. You know, that was 35 years ago, basically, and how much things have changed and how many opportunities there are. I think if I could choose to do it all over again, I think I would entrench myself in Mexico and, you know, follow the path of Diana Kennedy and, you know, research every little corner of that country and the food there, because I just, you know, it's so compelling to me. And I think that there's so much hidden away that, you know, it still hasn't really been accessed.
Were you paid?
No. Mm-mm, no. No, it was, you know, it was an education that, you know, I paid for out of pocket. And yeah.
That's, I guess, the reason I asked, is it dead now? Because you have to pay people now, which is a good thing.
Yeah.
Well, a lot of people just can't afford to pick up and
right.
go apprentice anymore.
Yeah, and I guess, you know, I was actually technically illegal also, you know, so I wasn't really supposed to be there doing that. I remember one time when I cut my finger at Trois Gros, and they were like, oh my God, what are we going to do? We can't send you to the hospital in your chef's whites, and you have to change your clothes and then pretend that you were a guest, and you slammed your finger. You know, it was just like this whole thing that happened, you know, and so, you know, that kind of stuff is just, it's crazy.
Yeah. Now that you own your own restaurants, you must just think back to that and be like, oh my God.
Yeah, it was, you know, and it was amazing. I mean, you know, like I said, I would have never, you know, had I known what I was getting myself into, I don't think I would have done it. But
so then you went and worked in more kitchens in France.
Yeah.
What happened after that?
Well, I came back to New York in between. So I was here in New York for a year and a half in the middle of that, and then went back to France. So I split it up between, had New York was sandwiched in the middle. So that was, so then I came back and went back to Los Angeles and opened Patina in 1989. So I was 23 years old when I opened that restaurant as a chef de cuisine.
God, and you had done so much already.
Yeah. I mean, that's the, you know, the crazy thing is just how much I crammed into, you know, the 7 years of you know, working here and working in France.
Okay, so let's jump ahead several years to San Francisco, because now you've got seven, I mean, you've had so many businesses over the years, and right now you've got seven, which is mind-boggling. One scrambles my brain. So tell us, walk us through your San Francisco empire.
Well, Jardiniere is 21 years old, and, you know, that's my baby, my flagship. I opened Mijita in 2002, which was sort of a dream for me to express myself in Mexican food, and that was my soul food I grew up with. And so.
And your heritage is Mexican and French Arcadian?
Yeah, exactly, and there's a little Scandinavian thrown in there, too. So, you know, I did Mijita, and I now have two other restaurants that are, you know, kind of Mexican-based. American Pub at Public House, which is, you know, a beer hall for Giants fans, basically. Then, you know, the Presidio opportunities came up, and just amazing. It's, you know, this great frontier in San Francisco. And
tell people what the Presidio is for those who haven't been there.
Yeah. So the Presidio was a military base until 1989 when it was turned over to the Presidio Trust for development. And so, you know, it's kind of a place stuck in time, where a lot of the officers lived in. And now it's this great, amazing parkland, great place to visit for people, you know, from around the world. And we've started a food and beverage program there, which is, you know, lovely. We have a commissary, Arguello, Transit Cafe, catering. And it's the park is just incredible. So, you know, you can traipse around, hike, and see all these amazing vistas and visit the restaurants.
And what about School Night, your new project?
So School Nights are really interesting. We kind of decided to launch that restaurant in January. And it had all been built out already. So, you know, it was a super tight timeline. But I'd been talking to the people at the Pearl, and, you know, everyone's talking about the need in our industry for a new model. And so constantly searching around for something that's going to make more financial sense and be, you know, more successful, because San Francisco is just, we've come to this point where we're kind of, it's a zero-sum game. You know, we're kind of sitting at a break-even, you know, making a little bit of money and enough to stay alive, but the model's really broken, and it needs to be fixed, and it needs to be addressed. And I think, you know, the industry leaders are talking about this right now, and everybody's sort of in this conundrum as to, you know, what's next and what should we be doing. And so School Night was really an effort to address some of those issues and look at a different way of doing business.
Now, you've never been afraid to do different things. I ate at Jardiniere last year for the 20th anniversary and had the Impossible Burger.
Yes.
While I was there, and I was like, how cool that Chef Tracy is just willing to go for it and try this and tell people what the Impossible Burger is.
Yeah, so the Impossible Burger is a plant-based meat. And it's funny, working with the company now for almost 3 years, I've really come to think of it as meat. In my mind, it holds that spot. So it's made entirely out of plants. It is, I think, difficult to discern the difference between that and ground beef. It is that close to the real deal. The company is amazing. The intention is about, you know, doing good for the environment and creating a food system that is more sustainable. And it's so compelling. When I first tried the product, I was just blown away. Even though, you know, I'm certainly not a vegan or a vegetarian. I definitely eat animals. But, you know, we need big solutions to big problems in what we're doing to this planet. How we're going to feed this growing population. And the company is just it's visionary. I mean, this product is something like nothing I've seen in my 35 years of cooking. It just is.
Yeah, it was delicious. I would not have known, had I not known what I was eating, I would have thought I was just eating a burger.
Yeah.
Not a plant-based product. But it was also super cool because Chardonnière is kind of fancy.
Yeah.
And it's a beautiful space. And you walk in and you can get this like super groovy experimental burger.
Yeah. And it, you know, it brought a whole new clientele to us. You know, millennials were just, we were only the second restaurant in the country to serve the Impossible Burger. So they were literally lining up and ready to embrace the Impossible Burger. And it was a very funny cultural shift because, you know, we are very fine dining and yet we wanted to do this burger. And, you know, people would come in with backpacks and, you know, they'd want us. And they'll say, oh, we'll just sit on the floor. And like, yeah, you can't sit on the floor at Chardonnière. Sorry. Like, you know, we're all about the burger and want to have a good time here. But let us find you a seat.
Well, we had such a good time. I was with my friends Pete and Ben from college, and we had one of those round banquettes, and our server had been there forever, and
yeah.
It was just such a great guy, but it was a lot of fun. Let's talk about your collaboration with mm-hmm. Salt and Straw
yeah.
that I kind of mentioned earlier. Salt and Straw, I'm sure most of you know, is just one of the hottest ice cream brands out there right now, founded by Kim Malik, who is, I'm sure you spent time with Kim,
amazing.
The kindest person
yeah.
on the planet. She was on the radio show last year. I don't know. Everything's blurring together. Maybe last year, maybe
yeah.
a few months ago. How did you and Kim hook up to do this collab?
So we met, I was doing an anniversary dinner actually for the 20th year anniversary at Chardonnière, and they were coming into the neighborhood, and I wanted to embrace all of the wonderful women we have working in Hayes Valley. And so the 20th anniversary was a celebration of all of these incredible women, Dominique Crenn and Kim Alter and Salt and Straw was coming. So I invited her to dinner, and we met and just really hit it off. And she introduced me to Tyler, and we started talking about doing a collaboration, which was so fun.
How did you decide? Can you tell us about the flavor?
Yeah, so we did. We ended up doing.
It's not typical.
No, definitely not. We sent about 8 prototypes to Tyler, and you know, half of them I think were pretty amazing, and he kind of just riffed off of that and sent us the samples back. And I liked a lot of them, but the duck fat one was the one that really grabbed my. I mean, we've served a ton of duck at Chardonnière over the years, and so it's kind of our signature thing. And I just loved the way that it played out in the ice cream. So it was duck fat ice cream with cherry conserve. And he made, actually Tyler, a brittle out of the duck skin. So you get this salty, sweet, crunchy, you know, duck skin shot in the ice cream. And originally we did it with kumquats because it was the season that they, you know, kumquats were around. But then we ended up doing cherry instead because it was for summer. And
it was just so good.
Did you like it?
Oh my God, I loved it. I mentioned we were in Portland, and I was like, thank God I'm finally in Portland because I have not had Salt and Straw ice cream yet. Last time I was in San Francisco, they hadn't opened. And so we drove out to the space, and the line was down the block.
I
was like, there are 3 locations. This has been in your backyard forever, and people are still lining up for it. That's how good it is. And so we got up to the front of the line, and I saw all the collabs, and it was you and Nancy Silverton and the 2 Sarahs from Kismet.
Mm-hmm.
And some guy. I forget which guy.
Yeah, Brian Malarkey, I think.
But
right?
I actually said to the scooper, I said, I just want the female flavors. And I'm sure because you can get, they have a really cool sampler. You get like this special dish, and I think you can get like 4 flavors. And she's like, well, you get 4 flavors. And I'm like, I don't care. I don't want the guy. Give me the olive oil.
That's hilarious. That's funny.
So I tried the olive oil.
Yeah.
And then we also did try the honey lavender flavor, which was gorgeous. But it was so much fun to try your flavors. And I sort of didn't even know that the collab had happened when I walked in. So I was very excited because I love all of you who did the collabs. And speaking of the Sarahs from Kismet, I bumped into Sarah Hymanson on the subway
night. Yeah, they were in town last night for the Beard Awards.
Yeah, so tell us what you're doing in town.
So I was at the Beard House last night, and I got to cook hors d'oeuvres for, you know, all these amazing chefs that are part of the Taste America tour, which is kicking off. So that was what we were all in town for. And Stuart and Nicole were here from State Bird and Progress and all kinds of fabulous, Val Cantu from Californios, and so they'll be setting off on the road to visit different cities in America and, you know, bring the foundation to other markets.
So cool.
Yeah.
All right. We are going to take a quick break to hear from our sponsors, and we will be right back with Chef Tracy Desjardins. It's time for our Bob's Red Mill Minute. I have a confession. Do you ever convince yourself to eat something because you think it's healthy, but you're really not sure why it's healthy or what prompted you to start eating it? I must have read somewhere that ground up flaxseed is good for you because I always sprinkle it on my yogurt and fruit when I have that for breakfast in the morning. As I sprinkled some Bob's Red Mill Organic Golden Flaxseed Meal on my yogurt and raspberries this morning at Cherry Bomb HQ, I realized I knew nothing about flaxseed meal. So here we go. It's the ground up version of flaxseed, also known as linseed, which comes from the flax plant, cultivated for its seeds as well as its fiber. The seeds, which are a little larger than sesame seeds, are an excellent source of omega-3 fatty acids and are rich in dietary fiber. In Bob's case, they grind the flaxseed on cool mills to preserve the healthful oils. In case you're wondering what it tastes like, the ground flaxseed has a nutty but neutral flavor. I keep mine in the fridge, and you should too, because it's a perishable product. You'll see there's an expiration date on the packaging. In addition to using ground flaxseed to top your yogurt, you can mix some into your smoothies or sprinkle it on top of your oatmeal. Thanks to Bob's Red Mill for making the best products around and for offering the healthy, wholesome ingredients we love so much. Are you daydreaming about culinary school again? Make this the year your dreams become reality with Le Cordon Bleu, the legendary culinary school. Study classic French culinary techniques in cuisine and patisserie as part of their exclusive 9-month Le Grand Diplôme and graduate into a world of opportunity. You also can extend your course of studies to include culinary management and dedicated internships. Le Cordon Bleu has locations in more than 20 countries around the world, and located within some of the best food cities out there: London, Ottawa, Madrid, Bangkok, Tokyo, and of course, the spiritual home of cuisine and Le Cordon Bleu, Paris. Turning your daydreams into reality is closer than ever. Visit cordonbleu.edu for more and let your culinary adventure begin. Hi, everybody. Welcome back to Radio Cherry Bomb. I am your host, Carrie Diamond, and we are here with Chef Tracy Desjardins from San Francisco. And I'm so psyched she's in the studio with us today. She is a big personal hero of mine. We were just talking about garbage, of all things. And Tracy, you know what I didn't mention? A lot of people have inspired me. I talked about this green canteen thing that we're doing at my coffee shop and trying to get rid of single-use plastics. And a lot of people have inspired me. Like I mentioned, my brother Pat is a big environmentalist. Mm-hmm. He's actually talked on the show and really brought it to my family's, the whole single-use plastic thing, to my family's attention. Balloons, straws, everything. My friend Electra Wiedemann, I don't know if you've ever met Electra. She has a site called The Impatient Foodie, has a really great website. She's a new mom. But she and I worked together back in my Lancôme days, and she was one of our spokesmodels. She actually asked if we could set up a meeting in Paris with the people who made the packaging for the company, because she was upset that it wasn't green enough. And so we met with them, and that was so long ago. And she, you know, I really admire her for that, because most spokesmodels just kind of cash their check and run. But she was really committed to making a difference. And then Lauren Singer, who's this incredible young woman. She's also been on the show. She has a site called Trash is for Tossers. And Lauren, every year, throws away enough garbage to fit into a mason jar. She is unbelievable. So if you want to learn some best practices, definitely check out what Lauren is doing. But another big inspiration on me was our Jubilee conference in San Francisco. Because San Francisco is so far ahead of the curve. And we wanted it to be the greenest conference we had ever done, but it had to be the greenest conference we'd ever done because San Francisco mandates that.
Right.
Like everything you have to sign, when you sign your venue contract, they don't know plastic water bottles, like right. all these rules. So it really pushed us to be green, and we had no plastic water bottles. I don't think we had any plastic bottles of any kind. We brought in like a portable water situation,
yeah,
so people could
right.
refill their bottles.
Yeah.
We donated all the food. You've some fantastic organizations in San Francisco that collect
yep.
food. I'm not talking
Absolutely.
About like shitty yeah. leftovers that nobody wants to touch.
Right.
But like, you know, there's beautiful food left over sometimes
yeah.
after events. And yeah. these groups collect them and bring them to shelters. But there were so many things that just really pushed us to be better and greener in San Francisco. And you were just saying, you can't believe New York still doesn't have a composting program.
I it's just shocking to me. I mean, I've been here yeah. for almost a week staying at my sister-in-law's, and it just is crazy to me that there's no compost program. And I remember talking to Mark Ladner about that many years ago, probably 10 years ago. And it's absolutely just mind-boggling to
yeah.
me.
Well, you know, they had started testing compost pickup, residential pickup, around the city, but I actually met yesterday with his name is Council Member Espinal. He's a really great guy. He has been leading the charge against straws and things like that. And he represents, actually, he represents this district, I think. He's mm-hmm. District 37 in New York City. And he had mentioned that there have been a lot of issues with composting and people just don't know how to compost. So they're not doing, I have to find out exactly what's happening, but I think they're not doing as much compost pickup as they had been.
Yeah. I mean, I remember when we made the cultural shift at the restaurant, and that was probably 15, 16 years ago. And, you know, it was difficult for probably, 4 to 6 months. And then once the staff kind of got the hang of it, that we had three different bins and, you know, this is what goes into this one. And it just becomes, part of that muscle memory and isn't difficult anymore. And it just, it should be happening in every city in America. I mean, there's no reason why. We basically went from, a situation at the restaurant where about 70% of our garbage was going into landfill to now it's like around 7%.
Wow, that's great.
Yeah, so everything gets recycled, composted. Obviously, bottles and cans, that's the easy one. But, everything else is getting, repurposed. And
you know what I think it is? We just, when we all get together, it's not the stuff we talk about.
I love talking about garbage.
We get together and we talk about our feelings. And
yeah.
We talk about what's trendy and things like that. But I think we have to start, we here on the East Coast and in New York in particular need to reach out to our friends on the West Coast because you're way ahead of it.
Yeah. I mean, and I think even consumers, one of the things I've noticed being here for the last few days is every restaurant, it seems, in New York puts a straw in your drink. And I mean, how many people actually drink out of a straw other than kids? I mean, like, I don't drink out of a straw. I might use it to sort of stir it for a second and then I take it out and put it on the table. So what's up with the straw thing here?
I think you talked about muscle memory, and I think a lot of people just can't get past that habit of putting it in your drink. And you really have to ask now. Like I got spoiled because we had stopped doing it at the coffee shop, and I frequent restaurants that I think share my values. And then you go to a restaurant that doesn't do it, and you're like, oh, shit, I forgot to ask.
Yeah.
You really, the second you order, you have to say, please don't bring me a straw.
Yeah, but, a friend of mine was talking about this, and she said, well, when she requests that, what usually happens is she'll just see the waiter or the bartender put it in the drink and then take it out and put it in the garbage. So it's like, no. I mean, I think actually we have to be more conscious about it, which is, like, call the restaurant after you've been there and say, hey, can you stop using straws? Or only do it on request. We as consumers, the people that are paying the bills and spending our money, we have the right to demand that and to say, hey, I don't need a straw.
Yeah. And if you do a beach cleanup, you see straws everywhere. And, it's not just the full size straws from restaurants. It's those little juice box straws.
Terrible.
And the little piece of plastic that holds them
yep.
to the box and balloons.
Yeah.
So yeah. many balloons. You don't need balloons, people.
I know. I had my niece and nephews up at my house in the mountains a couple weeks ago, and my brother decided to do water balloons. And afterwards, I was just appalled at the shrapnel, the balloon little pieces everywhere. And I felt like the bad auntie, but I made the kids go and pick them all up. And it felt mean, but yeah. I was like, look at this mess.
We've, you know, I know a lot of PR people listen to the show. Our intern Liv is sitting in the control booth and laughing because I'm referencing her, but I won't say who did this because it was a very major, major person in the industry who I think would be mortified if he knew this is what his PR firm sent out. But I was sent a thing of bubbles, like bubbles that you blow with a wand, uh-huh. and a little plastic thing this big in a box that, I don't know, size of a box you could fit a bowling ball in, with a balloon, a helium balloon attached to it. And they paid for a messenger to bring that from Manhattan to my office in Brooklyn.
Wow.
And I was like, are you effing kidding me? And I used to do PR, and I was really tough on the team. I was like, please don't bring us these BS promotional things. Like, if a product is not good enough to stand on its own, maybe you shouldn't be sending this product out or even making this product. And if you're a PR person and you are like the equivalent of a bottom feeder and take on these like crappy brands that can only survive by sending out like lots of
helium balloons
balloons and stuff, I don't know. Don't take them as clients. I know life's hard, but like, it's not the way forward.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we all need to be more mindful of, you know, everything. I mean, when you think about packaging, like that is, you know, and it's a way that we as consumers can really have a voice. And you're buying the stuff, you know, object to the way it's packaged. Like, do we really need everything to be encased in these giant plastic, you know, whatevers all the time? I mean, it's amazing.
Yeah, absolutely. I was in, oh gosh, which supermarket, Fairway or something the other day, and I was grocery shopping. And I walked past this woman, and she was at the bulk. I'm trying to find her information. She was at the bulk
food
section,
bin bins,
you know, with the nuts and all of that. And Sarah Weinreb. And I didn't recognize her at first. We met like once before, but she was packing all her stuff into reusable bags.
Yeah.
And I walked past her, and I was like, "Oh, are you?" I recognized the bag. Somebody had sent them to me. They were these silicone bags, and I hadn't tried them yet. And I said, are those bags? And she said, yeah, they are. And all of a sudden we realized like we knew each other. But I was just so happy to see somebody who like really cares, who was out there living her values, you know, not just taking the plastic bag to put her almonds in because that's what was right there.
Yeah, I know. My son recently said to me, you know, I'm not going to eat anything that comes prepackaged in plastic anymore. And, you know, that's my challenge to you. So I just need to let you know that, you know, I'm not going to do that. And so, you know, whatever you're buying to feed me, it needs to not be packaged in plastic.
You know, your chef soul will be crushed when I tell you this story. So I went to a barbecue place in Brooklyn, waited online, very popular barbecue place, excellent barbecue. And I got up there and I placed my order for the table. And I watched as they took out each like serving that had been pre-cooked and packaged individually in plastic wrap, and they would cut through the plastic wrap and threw it on the stove or whatever. And I was like, I couldn't believe what was happening in front of my eyes.
Yeah.
I was like, all this barbecue has been pre-cooked.
Right.
And
does it have to be
wrapped in plastic and then recooked? And I was just like, wow, that is a bummer.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, I don't want to live in fantasy land and expect that like they're cooking my barbecue right in front of me, because I know that's not something that happens instantly. But
yeah, it's tough. I mean, you know, we use cryovac bags for, you know, preserving a lot of stuff in restaurants, and it's a super, you know, way to keep it moist and clean and everything, you know, that comes along with that. But man, the amount of refuse that, you know, we're kicking off and plastic wrap and all of that. So, you know, all of that stuff needs to be thought out, and we need better solutions for, you know, all of it.
Well, it's starting. It's definitely starting.
Yeah.
There's a wonderful example in New York City. It's a little cafe called Anko Lee that's in Greenwich Village, and zero plastic.
Wow.
Everything is in glass. They even serve their ice drinks in glass for people to take. And Chloe, who's the founder, designed these beautiful glasses, and you can leave with them and you return them and you get a dollar back. And I said to her, I was like, they're so pretty. No one's going to bring them back. And she was like, oh, I'm not worried. Everybody's apartments are so small. They can't keep that many of
them.
That's
amazing. I'm going to go check it out.
But it's really, it is, I think it's the most sustainable restaurant in the country. And she, is from France, and she said when she first came to America and she saw people throwing their garbage out in these giant hefty bags, she was horrified.
Right.
She said back home in France, like, my parents would throw the trash out and it was like a tiny, tiny bag.
Because they're composting and, you know, they just naturally did all of that stuff. And it's, you know, it's amazing, you know, what happens. I mean, we had a huge garbage problem for years before we started the composting program, but everything shrinks down a lot more when you do compost and you have live food waste and, you know, you're dealing with that as versus bags full of air, basically. I mean, that's what you see. And that's what, I mean, it just strikes me in New York. You just see these giant piles of, like, you know, garbage.
I know, it's terrible. Yeah. Well, anyway, we're trying to make a difference. And if there are like-minded souls out there, please get in touch with me because I really want to hear from you. And like I said, I think it's about all of us in the industry just starting to share best practices and pushing each other to be better. And that's something you've done your whole career.
Well, thank
you.
Thank you.
How are things for women these days? What's your state of the state?
Well, state of the state, you know, I think the big question is, how do we redefine what successful women look like? I think that that's really the pivotal piece, because I think we've been trying to fit into a different skin for a long time. And, you know, sort of held up this, you know, what successful looks like is in the figure of man. And we need to define how to do it, you know, as a woman. And the way that we do things is different, and it should be. And bring that sensibility to what success looks like and what the future looks like.
And can you talk a little bit more about that? What do you think it looks like?
You know, again, I think that we have to embrace strong women. Mm-hmm. And we have to stop being critical of what that looks like and really understand that it's a different form than men. And I think it's, you know, it's obvious in the world of food. I think women have a very different sensibility in restaurants and how we cook. But it has to be recognized as such. Or valued more, I think, is actually the pivotal piece. Mm-hmm. And I think it is less showy. It is less, you know, Pellegrino Top 50 or whatever you want to, you know, call it. Women don't have a tendency to sort of project themselves in that way. And I think that we have to, and yet we really do value the cooking of so many women, but it's not, you know, I mean, April Bloomfield, you know, Gabrielle Hamilton, you know, their cooking is wonderful, but it's anything but
flashy. Those are two very interesting references you just threw out there.
Well, I know. I'm probably going to step in it, but I admire both of their cooking styles and sensibilities so much, and I think that they're the epitome of technique and strength in the dishes that they make. That is just so clear and so delicious. Jody Williams. I mean, I just went to Via Carota the other day for lunch, and you know, the cooking was so soulful. I mean, I had a pesto that was like a revelation. How is it that a pesto can be a revelation? But it's just such soulful, you know, beautiful food that has so much character behind it. And it resonates. But does anyone, you know, do people really notice that? Do they appreciate it to the level that they do Redzepi or, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. You know, since you brought those two women up, I will say one thing that continues to frustrate me with the Me Too conversation and how restaurants should be evolving is a lot of these groups that were part of the Me Too conversation because of bad behavior and other things that were happening at their restaurants have not come forward with any kind of statements about the future and how they expect, how they will be running their places moving forward, why we should give them our hard-earned dollars, mm-hmm. why the media should give them attention, right. why they should be considered for reviews or awards or any of that. Like, they just are sort of pretending like nothing happened. And
I think everybody's just scared. You know, it's a scary moment in time, and I think it's something that none of us could have anticipated was going to happen on this scale. And so I think that we have to soften our stance a little bit and understand that we could have never imagined where we are today. And so everyone has to take a deep breath and figure out where to place themselves in this complex, I think, moment. You know, I think that we also have to acknowledge that there have been a lot of really amazing kitchens, men leading them, women leading them, that have existed in peace without great notoriety, but were great places to work and productive and amazing. And I think we have to acknowledge that. You know, I was talking to Rick Bayless in Aspen this summer, and you know, he's like, our kitchens have always been fabulous, you know, and it's like, we've always had a lot of women and a lot of men and, you know, just great places to work. And I think that that's, you know, we have to look at that too, because I think we're sort of searching for the bad and to identify that so that we don't have to continue to do it. But I think we have to also look for the good and look for people who've been doing the right thing for a long time and acknowledge that. And maybe it's not a cutting, you know, cutting newsworthy, you know, but really amazing. And I think that that's what we have to look for, because there are a lot of great men out there and, you know, they've always done the right thing. And so I will defend those people. Absolutely.
Yeah. I mean, there are a ton of great people in general, and mm-hmm. I agree with you, you know, they deserve the attention, but I would still like to see some kind of moving forward manifesto from these folks.
Yeah.
In terms of, because they're still open for business.
Yeah.
You know, I want to know that things are different.
Right. And, you know, the big question is, are they, you know, and have they, you know, solved those issues mm-hmm. and are they moving forward in positive ways that, you know, really, I mean, here's the thing, you know, I was in this conversation, I was talking to, you know, a journalist about this, and I said, you know, these are laws, you know, and if you just followed the law, I mean, you know, I remember when sexual harassment laws came into place, and it was sometime in the 90s, and I was already running a restaurant, and I was always like a pretty physical person, you know, like hugs and kisses and whatever, you know, in the kitchen. And I sort of had this moment where I was like, okay, I need to be a little more conscious of what I'm doing with my body, whatever, you know. And, you know, they were laws, and we studied them, and we studied what we were supposed to do and not do. And, you know, if you followed the law, you were okay, you know? And so it's sort of the same thing, you know, today, you know, anti-bullying laws are just coming into place. And I definitely was at one point in time a pretty intense, you know, I yelled and screamed and was not the nicest person on the planet running my kitchens. And, you know, now we have to recognize that that behavior is absolutely unacceptable now as well, and change that culture in our kitchens and find more productive ways to talk to each other and to be.
Absolutely. Yeah. I definitely feel, though, as a member of the media, a member of the restaurant community, and a customer, a former customer of most of these places, you know, I would like to hear a little something from them about how they're changing.
I agree.
Yeah.
I agree.
But you gave that great quote to Kim in that New York Times piece I referenced earlier. You said, we're not past it by any means, but it's time to focus on the people who are doing it right. And there are plenty of them.
Yeah.
And you are one of them.
Thank you.
okay. We're almost out of time. Are you having a good summer?
I'm having a fabulous summer. It's great. My son just graduated from high school. He's going off to college. So,
oh, congratulations. Been,
thank you.
That's a big deal.
Yeah. Yeah. It's exciting. And so I've been spending a lot of time with him and getting out in nature and in the mountains, which is where I love to be. You know,
yeah. What are you looking forward to for the fall?
You know, it's interesting. Going back to work, you know, not having a son at home anymore, it's kind of exciting because I feel like my time is my own again and I can engage in you know, restaurant hospitality and being in the restaurants at night again. And so I'm excited about that. I still love what I do and love to feed people and you know, tailor their experiences in the restaurants. And so I'm looking forward to it.
We should give a few shout outs to some people doing the right thing. You very kindly brought to our attention the team behind Miracle Plum.
Yes.
Do you want to talk about them a little?
Yeah. So they're just Miracle Plum are two dear friends of mine who were about to launch a food business up in Santa Rosa right when the fires broke out last October. And so they were delayed, given sort of the financial needs of people who were impacted by the fire. And they are launching. So they've got their doors will be open starting the very beginning of August. And so it's super exciting.
And you can find them on Instagram at miracle.plum if you want to follow what they're doing. And if you find yourself in Santa Rosa, you should definitely go investigate, right?
Yeah, check it out.
And then you've got Tracy's whole empire. If you're going to San Francisco or the Bay Area, or you happen to live out there, you have a whole range of businesses you can check out. Should people start with Jardiniere?
Jardiniere, absolutely, because that's the flagship, the mothership, as I like to call it. And School Night's been, you know, really, it's really fun, easy bar. You know, the food is, cocktails are delicious. The food is very approachable, Mexican mostly. Super, super fun. The restaurants in the Presidio, Commissary, Arguello. Arguello has the most incredible patio for a sunny day. So, Ooh. Yeah, come check it out.
Oh, that sounds great. You know, we're all about supporting women run businesses and small businesses. So please go check out Tracy's businesses. Tell her, send her a little message from your table. Tell her Cherry Bomb sent you. So that's it for our show. Thank you, Tracy.
Thanks for having me, Carrie.
I really appreciate you coming by, and thanks for everything you do for the industry and for women and all of it.
Thank you.
Thank you to our sponsors, Bob's Red Mill, best friend of every baker we know, and Le Cordon Bleu, the legendary culinary school. Radio Cherry Bomb is a joint production of Cherry Bomb Magazine and Heritage Radio Network. You can subscribe to our show wherever you listen to podcasts, and you can subscribe to Cherry Bomb Magazine at cherrybomb.com. Our theme song is by Tra La La, and today's show was engineered by our friend DJ Dave Tatasciore. Thanks for listening, everybody. You're the bomb. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.
Radio Cherry Bomb is powered by Simplecast. Simplecast is a popular hosting and analytics platform that allows podcasters to easily host and publish to apps like Apple Podcasts. If you have a podcast or are looking to create your very first, check it out. Try it for free and save half off your first 3 months at simplecast.com/heritage.